When I was a small boy, when my parents were called into God's church, and as most kids, you know, you want pocket money. And as I grew up, I was always looking for odd jobs, and it was kind of tough living out in the country where we did. But over the summer, you could maybe mow somebody's yard that was going to be out of town, or they needed extra help, or I would always look for the farmers towards the end of the summer season. You could always bale hay. And from that money, I would dutifully send in my first tithe. And I normally would keep it, actually, until it got to a point where it justified my parents writing a check for me. But, of course, then I would keep my second tithe and would take that money with me to the Feast of Tabernacles. But, obviously, it's so little money, it didn't last long. You know, I'd buy a few things, a couple of trinkets for myself, and it would be gone. But years passed, you know, and in high school, I get a part-time job with more regular hours, regular money. And, you know, all of that's fun as a teenager, because now you can buy back then it was records, you could go buy the records you wanted to listen to, you could buy whatever extra clothing your parents couldn't afford or didn't want to buy for you, be able to go to movies with your friends and so forth, and continue to save up my tithe. And so the year after high school, I worked even more hours, since I'm not in school now, to earn money. I didn't know what I was going to do initially, whether I'd go to college, whether I would do something else, or just go into the workforce and try to figure out a career. And so that year after high school was special, because it was the first year I had worked full-time. I had real money, you know, so not just during the year, but at the feast. I was 19 years old, and, of course, you know, the world is your oyster, isn't it? The possibilities are almost limitless, it seems. And so that year for the feast, my friend Tim and I drove his 1964 Ford Fairlane. That doesn't sound like a very impressive car, but he'd souped it all up. We thought we were just the cat's pajamas in that car. So what was especially special about that whole trip, though, was the first feast that I was on my own completely. My own money for the hotel and food and all the other stuff that came with it. You know, we listened to our music going down. We had our own hotel room. And as I mentioned, you know, we're just top of the world. I have a lot of really good memories about that trip. But, of course, none of it would have happened without money. And it's funny how life works that way. But especially because it was feast money. So today we're going to review the fundamental belief number 18, and that is the doctrine of tithing. So let's begin in Deuteronomy 14, and as you're turning there, I'll read to you our doctrinal statement. It simply says, we believe in tithing as a way of honoring God with our substance and as a means of serving him in the preaching of the gospel, the care of the church, attending the festivals, and helping the needy. So the word tithe simply means a tenth from our English. In the context, then, of tithing before God, it means to set aside a tenth of our money as an offering to God. The practical practice, then, is our increase, and we'll develop that thought more as we progress here. But let's read Deuteronomy 14 and in verse 22. God here, through Moses, is again reminding Israelites about this tithe. He says, you shall surely tithe all the increase of your grain. So as a farmer, you don't know that increase until the end of the year, do you? Typically, up until, I don't know, it's been the last 20 or so years, maybe a little longer, farmers would save seed. You know, like corn, you'd save your seed corn. You'd hold back a certain amount so you'd have something to plant the next year. Now they just buy that seed from various companies, but you don't know if you have fruit trees. You don't know in the spring if you get a late frost, what's that going to do to your crop? You know, all these sort of things. So God's not asking us to give a tenth before we know what it is. So he says, of your increase. So for us, we're not farmers. We're earning a paycheck, working various jobs. But at the end of the year, what it is post-taxes. So he says, the grain of your field as it produces year by year, the tithe of your increase. And so even in business, God doesn't ask us to tithe before we know what our income is. Typically, if you own your own business, you're going to pay your taxes quarterly. And so each quarter you could anticipate, but I know people that have their businesses that do it at the end of the year because it might be even more or less depending on the year they're having. And so that we look at this in a modern context, it's really the same principle, though, the increase of what God has blessed us with. But before we develop this any further, let's ask and answer the question, why does God need our tithe? And the answer is he doesn't. He doesn't. Let's look at that in Haggai chapter 2. That's the challenge of the day. find Haggai 2, since we don't turn there very often. Haggai chapter 2 and verse 8 simply says, "The silver is mine and the gold is mine, says the Eternal of hosts. What could we give God that was not His to begin with?" The answer is nothing. I mean, everything we have, even if we are a big conglomerate and we find a rich vein of whatever ore, right now, if you found a vein of pure lithium, you'd be set for life multiple times. You know, but they go out and they find these things, they invest. It's already God's, isn't it? He put it there. The gold, the silver, iron, oil, gas, you know, whatever it is that we're looking at, it was His to begin with. He created it. The act of tithing, then, is an acknowledgement that everything we have comes from God. That God is the creator, and if you will, He's the owner of everything that's in the universe and whatever else that we discover in that creation. Whatever wealth we have, whatever increase we have, even the life we have was not ours. It came from God to begin with. Let's look at that thought again in Psalm 24. Psalm 24 and verse 1. Sorry, I'm in the wrong book. Let me get there. Psalm 24 and verse 1, David writes, "The earth is the Eternal's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein." So, if we want to look at it this way, a tithe is simply a user fee. Some of you are familiar with that term. It's not really. We'll come back to that thought as well. But, you know, if you had a friend of great wealth, he said, "I'll let you use my car. All I'm asking you to do is put gas in it." That's essentially a user fee, isn't it? It doesn't cost you anything except the gas. You don't have to pay the insurance, maintenance, taxes, whatever else. God is doing the same here, as David wrote. The earth and its fullness already is God's. But God calls this a tithe, this 10%. And it's part of the covenant He made with ancient Israel. And some think that it was only with Israel. But we know that's not the case. Let's turn to Genesis 14. Because tithing predates and postdates the covenant that God made with Israel. But usually it's because they don't want to follow the Old Testament instruction. And so they say that that was only a covenant with Israel and we don't have to keep that. And they're missing out, unfortunately. Even if it's a lack of understanding, it's not deliberate, they miss out on blessings that come from it. And we'll see that as we progress as well. But here in Genesis 14, we have the example of Abraham. Now, in the context of this illustration, if you will, what had happened is that the kings of the valley of Sidon, and we don't usually reference that much, but it's the valley that's the southeast corner of the Dead Sea going south. Along this valley, there were a number of what we would call city-states, kingdoms that were basically just cities. And they each had a king, and there were other kings that came into the area as a coalition, and they just went through the area and they just took everything, all the people, all the wealth, animals, everything. Well, within that was Sodom, where Lot was. And when Abraham or Abram had heard that Lot was taken, he took his men, he went out, and he retook everything. So this is the context. Genesis 14, verse 18. It says here, "Then Melchizedek, after he had defeated these kings," he's coming back, Abram is, "Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High." Now, as an aside, if you go to Hebrews 7, and actually a couple of other places, we know that this Melchizedek was the pre-incarnate Christ. Okay, so he's still representing God. He's a priest of God. Notice what Melchizedek does to Abram, verse 19. "He blessed him and said, 'Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth.'" So we read those verses, Haggai 2, verse 8, Psalm 24, verse 1. Again acknowledged here, "Possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And then it switches. It's not Melchizedek talking now. The "he" here, the first one, is Abram. "And he gave him," Abram gave Melchizedek, "a tithe of all." So this predates the Sinaitic covenant. So Abram was already tithing before that covenant was ever even acknowledged by Israel. Tithed on the spoils of war, if you will. Now, but not only was Abraham acknowledging the priest of God, and by extension, God himself, he was also acknowledging the victory and the success that God gave him was from him. So let's look at another example predating the Sinaitic covenant, Genesis 28 this time. This is Jacob and his story. He had had his falling out because of the deception of the birthright with Esau, and he's traveling now to ideally marry Rachel. But on his way, he stops, he has this dream, and in this dream, he acknowledges now, basically, I need to decide what I'm doing here. And he makes his covenant with God. So Genesis 28 and verse 20, it says, then Jacob made a vow. That's all a covenant is. Our marriages, our baptisms, they're vows before God. So it says, he made a vow saying, if God will be with me and keep me this way that I am going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the eternal shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house. And all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So Jacob as well tithed. Let's go next to Deuteronomy 8. For those that don't tithe, tithing is a concept that they can struggle to put their mind around. So we're familiar with this, but just for the point of illustration, you make $1,000, and now you have to set a tenth of that aside, don't you? So $100 you set aside. That's the first tithe. We'll touch briefly at the end on second, third tithe. But so it's then second tithe, another $100. If it's your third year, third tithe, another $100. So now instead of having $1,000, you have $700. And that's before the government even gets involved. So you see it disappearing, don't you? And you think, well, how does this work? Well, we have to remember what it is that we're doing. Again, tithing is an acknowledgement that everything is God's to begin with. So let's look at Deuteronomy 8, verse 18 to follow up on that thought. Here, again, Moses is recording God's instruction. He says, you shall remember the Eternal your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. So, not only are we acknowledging God as the source of all that is, but he is the source of what we have individually, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. Now, there are multiple extensions to this, because the interesting thing about God and blessings is they're not selfish. When God blesses us, it ends up being a blessing to others, doesn't it? I mean, look at Abraham. God promised to bless Abraham, but he said that it would also be a blessing to the whole world. You can look at that physically. You can look at that spiritually. This nation is a recipient physically of those blessings, which most people don't even understand at this point. But that he is the one who gives us power to get wealth. So again, when we tithe, we then also engage in worship of God as the source of our existence and blessings. And he can make up things in ways that we can't. You know, some of the blessings that come from tithe. I would hope that every one of you would have your own stories to share. When money was tight, especially, it seems we see these things. But let me just give you an example of a person I knew quite a long time back in my past. This is a man who had attended the Worldwide Church of God most of his life. And when the heresies of the early 90s were being promoted, he believed them, he followed them, he went along, and when Worldwide basically imploded, he quit attending. Along with that, not keeping the Sabbath and holy days, then, of course, he quit tithing. Because if you forget why, that looks like a pretty big bonus, doesn't it? Now, suddenly, I have all this money, and if I can interrupt myself here, which I can, I've known people who, unfortunately, who have left the church that have decided they wanted to count up all the money they've given in tithes and offerings. And it's like, why? But it just shows they didn't understand why they were giving it to begin with. So anyway, this man quit church, quit tithing, years passed, and rather than having a lot more disposable income that he thought he would have, actually had less. It was disappearing. His family lived in government-subsidized housing. They received food stamps. They shopped at a local food pantry, charity clothing stores to provide for themselves. They were always behind the financial eight ball. Now, to his credit, the years had passed, and they realized this isn't working. And rather than continue the insanity, they did the right thing, and they started coming back to church. But as they attended, they still had all these problems that they had created in the past by not following God's law. One of them was their financial landscape was still much the same. They would come to the church from time to time asking for assistance. It would be given, but as it looked like it was going to be regular, I needed to have a conversation with him. And in counseling them, I found out he still wasn't tithing. And so I said, "Why not?" He said, "I can't afford to tithe." And I looked at him and I said, "You can't afford not to tithe. Look at where you are." So I reassured them of God's promised blessings. I said, "I don't know how, I don't know why, where, all those things." I said, "But he promises he will." The curious thing was, one of the things that he started doing, he worked a state government job. And he started applying for other positions that would pay better. He would get first, second interviews, jobs would disappear, or they would pull it off, decide they weren't hiring anybody for those positions. He was getting a bit frustrated, but to his credit, he stuck with it. And in a matter of a few years, he got a better job. So he didn't lose his state pension, just transferred within the state system, but he had to move. Where they were living was in one of the major cities, and he moved to a part of the state that was more rural. He didn't make that much more money. It was a pay increase, which is always nice. But the bonus was, now that he was living in a different part of the state, his cost of living was lower. So the money went further. And for the first time in their lives, they were able to afford buying a house. They weren't on government assistance any longer. They didn't need the food pantries. They began to receive the blessings from God because of the obedience in tithing and other things. But tithing, for the sake of this sermon especially, when God placed tithing in the covenant he made with Israel, it's also interesting to note that he set aside the tribe of Levi, didn't he? They did not get an inheritance. They didn't own whole sections of land like the other tribes. They had cities that were basically designated for them, but they were not to work outside of their responsibilities as priests. And so the nation tithed to the priests, but the priests themselves tithed. Who did they tithe to? The Aaronic household. And so then you see that no matter what, there's a responsibility in this. Let's back up a little bit and read this in Numbers chapter 18. In Numbers 18, verse 23, this section moving forward in Numbers 18 is talking about this tithing to support the Levites and the tithing the Levites were to do. We're just going to read verse 23 here to begin with. It says, "But the Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations among the children of Israel that they should have no inheritance." Now, if we go back to what we read earlier, if God gives us the wealth, he still provides for them, doesn't he? Because they're doing his work. And so the nation then supported them through tithes. So if we move down to verse 26, it says, "Speak thus to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithes which I have given to you," see, the money is not ours, it's God's to begin with, "the money which I have given you from them as your inheritance, then you shall offer up a heave offering of it to the Lord, a tenth of the tithe." So even the Levites were to tithe. "And your heave offering shall be reckoned to you through, though it were a grain at the threshing floor, and as the fullness of the winepress, thus you shall also offer a heave offering to the Eternal from all your tithes which you receive from the children of Israel. You'll give to the Lord's heave offering from it to Aaron the priest." And that family was much smaller. But what we find here is a principle of God expecting, if you will, that all follow his instruction. What's really sad, well, let's just turn to Malachi chapter 3. What's really sad is that the Levites didn't always do well with this. They didn't continue to teach the nation not only that they needed to tithe, but why. And you would think of all people, the Levites would be on top of that, because that's their income, right? You need to tithe so I can eat. Well, they lost that. And Malachi is an indictment, if you will, that God is taking to the Levites, the priests, because they were not teaching his law. Tithing was one element of it. But tithing is very clear. And so in Malachi 3 and verse 8, you have this monologue dialogue with God here. It's only God talking, but he's already knowing what they're going to say. And so he says this as if he's having a conversation. Will a man rob God? Would you think to rob me? And so then the follow-up is, you have robbed me, but you say, in what way have we robbed you? How have I, you know, they might say to themselves, how have I taken anything from you? He answers, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation, because it wasn't theirs. Our tithe is not ours. We learn to honor and acknowledge God. We learn how he provides for us. And why he wants to, and the point of it all. So then verse 10, he says this, he gives them an action item here. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. Again, does he need our tithe? Does he need our offerings? Does he need our food or whatever? No, he doesn't. But he does in that he sees our heart when we do this. And so he says, try me now. I like the old King James better. Prove me now. Put it to the test. Tithing is very much an act of faith, isn't it? I've got $1,000 and I've got $1,200 of bills. Government takes their 30%. I set aside a first and second tithe. How do I make that work? God does. The clothes that don't wear out, like Israel, they went 40 years and their clothes didn't wear out. Those are some good clothes. I'd like to have some clothes that last 40 years like that. Of course, it wouldn't be fashionable any longer. But anyway, you know, the cars that don't wear out, how we're protected. What money would you put towards that alone to know how you're protected? All of these things. So he says, prove me, says the eternal host. Notice, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. So it's not a tit for tat. I give God my 10%, he owes me that much back. God says, no. If you honor me, if you humble yourself, if you understand what it is that I'm asking for you to come to see, I'll give you even more than you give up, what you think you give up. A blessing such there will not be enough room to receive it. What is interesting is, as I said, the Levites weren't teaching this. So how were they getting paid? Bribes and things they shouldn't have been doing. And so God was giving them notice. You're not doing the right thing. So when we consider this, God's not even asking a user fee, is he? He's simply saying, I want to see that you will do this. If you will obey me, I'll take care of the rest. It'll work. And so we see it's not about the money. It's about worship before God, obedience, and this right heart. Let's move forward to Matthew 23. This was covered, I believe, last week in the sermonette here. And it is talking about tithing. But as was mentioned even in that sermonette, it's more than that, isn't it? Matthew 23 and verse 23. This chapter, Christ has really taken it to the Pharisees and the scribes. Because they don't get it. They're so letter of the law, they can't see anything beyond that. Now, letter of the law is good to an extent. We learn what it is that God is asking us to do, we learn to do it. Then we begin to understand the spirit of it, right? What God intends for us to learn from it. It's not God taking things away. It's teaching us through these physical things, and tithing is no different. So Matthew 23, verse 23, this is one more thing he's taking them to task for. Woe to you, he says, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, faith. Notice the end of this. He does not condemn them for keeping or doing tithing. This would have been the prime opportunity, wouldn't it? If he says, you know what, after all these thousands of years, you don't have to do this anymore. That's not what he says. These you ought to have done, the tithing of mint, anise, and cumin, without leaving the others undone, justice, mercy, faith. Now, to show you how fanatical they were about this, fanatical in the right way, I don't mean crazy, just precise. How do you count out mint, anise, and cumin? Have you ever seen those seeds? They are tiny. Can you imagine? Let's say you have a pound of mint. You're going to count all of them and then recount 10%. Is that what you're going to do? Evidently, that's what they were doing. Can you imagine the time that takes? I'm a little lazier. I'm going to weigh it. I'm going to take 10%. I'm going to scoop a little more in, and I'm done. Okay? There's nothing wrong with that. I've done what God has asked me to do, but I have also not made tithing the worship, which is what they were doing. The tithing alone. Because we have to temper it, as it says here, with justice, mercy, faith. This is why I say this is about worshiping God, less about the money. So he magnified the application, didn't he? So tithing is not just setting aside the money. It's remembering all these things we've touched on. This is what Israel forgot. This is what the priests forgot. This is what the Pharisees and the scribes at this point didn't know. What they never understood and what too many miss even today in not doing this. And the interesting thing is, I know some people who tithe that are not, as we would acknowledge, in God's church. And they're still blessed. But it is still an act of faith, isn't it? Especially, as I said, when you don't have money. Those first couple of jobs I had when I was younger, you know, you mow somebody's yard and you get paid $10 and suddenly a dollar of it's gone. You begin to appreciate the value of it, don't you? But we also have to be careful that we don't tithe out of habit. Do we tithe out of habit? It can be possible. If we do it for years, we may not even think about doing it. And that's not on its own wrong, but if we just write the check, send it off, and we're not thinking about what we're doing, then we're missing the other component, aren't we? The worship component. And again, this is what the Pharisees forgot. They saw tithing as part of their righteousness. But we of all people should understand there's more to that. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 9. Sometimes we'll read this on one of the holy days when we're talking about the offerings that we bring to God. And it applies there, but it also applies to this topic. Even though it's not specifically talking about tithing here, it's talking about what's behind tithing. So 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 7, Paul writes here, "So let each one of you give as he purposes in his heart, notice, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver." There have been times in my history when we write out that tithe check, put it in the envelope, and I pray to God before I send it off, "I don't know how this is going to work, but you have promised that it will, and I'll wait to see." But it has to be done in the right heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, because God wants to see us do it willingly and happily. To know, again, that He is the creator of all, that He is the giver of all. So He not only requires we tithe, He wants a willing heart. And if we go back to Malachi 3, we can see that we can't outgive God. It's not a zero-sum game. You know, it's not the government. You give them money, you never see it. And you wonder if it was ever spent for what it was intended for. That's not God's way of doing things. Notice the next verse, verse 8. "And God is able to make all grace abound towards you." We can look at this spiritually. We should. But also don't forget, we're talking about tithing here, "that all grace may abound to you." Have you seen grace abounded to you when you tithe? I hope you do. Notice the rest. "Always having sufficiency." This is a challenge in our modern culture, isn't it? To be satisfied. We want more. We want bigger. We want better. It's never enough. But in tithing, we can also see that God will take care of us, and it's enough. Whatever enough is. You know, in spite of the times Roxanne and I struggled financially, the years and years that we did that, we were never destitute. We knew God was with us. We'd see the blessings, the provisions, and eventually we were no longer in that place. "But having all sufficiency," notice, "in all things, may have an abundance for every good work." The first tithe today is utilized then in the same way as the tithe to the Levites in Israel's time. That was stated in our fundamental belief, that we use it to pay the salaries of the ministry. We use it to have halls like this. We use it to print magazines and produce video, what we call the Great Commission or the gospel message. But let's go back to 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 9. For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. You can go back and read that. The principle was, the ox is doing the work. Let him eat. He's going to be the one going round and round and round and round all day long to help take care of your crop. So let him eat a little bit. Now that's a physical principle, isn't it? But Paul here is expounding the principle as it should be. And he asks the question, is it the oxen God is concerned about? Yes, but there's more. Does it also say it then together for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, for this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. This is why socialism, Leninism, Marxism, communism, fascism, that's why none of those systems work or last, because you take hope away. If I'm the farmer, and I'm clearing the field, I'm pulling the stones out, I'm taking the weeds out, I plow it, I plant it, I weed it, I take care of it. At the end of the year, the government comes in and says, it's all mine. Next year, am I going to do the same thing? No. Why? Why should I? This is what Paul is addressing here, because they weren't paying their tithes. That's why he's addressing this here. Macedonia was taking care of Paul. The Corinthians weren't. They were still too much in the world. He was teaching them. But it's here for us to remember as well. So he says, you do this for having hope. For if we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? I mean, look at Paul. It's just one example. The traveling, the persecution, trials he had. I mean, could you be beaten like Paul was more than once and say, I'm still there? I don't know. I've been stoned, not like Paul. I had brothers. We played with rocks. We weren't gentle with it. You know, to be stoned to a point of everyone, even the church members thinking you're dead, they carry you out, throw you on the trash heap. He awakes. That was probably pretty startling. And he gets up. What does he do? Goes back into town. I'm not done yet. I'm not dead yet. So he says, if I'm doing all of these things in God's service, is it awful that I would ask for you to help me? And that's, again, part of why we use the tithe the way we use it. Let's go next to Matthew 24. This is, as we call it, the commission, one example of it. And it takes money to do these things, doesn't it? To print the magazines and the booklets and the salaries, not just for the ministry, those that work at home office and serve in other capacities, the church halls, member assistance, feast sites, you know, all these things we do. Could God take care of those without our help? Probably, yeah. Yes, I shouldn't say probably. Yes, but probably even better than us. But what would we learn? We'd be selfish little children. Every time we wanted something, God's just expected to take care of it. He wants our involvement to see what he's doing, to be a part of it. So in Matthew 24 and verse 14, before he answers the question that was asked at the beginning of the chapter, what is the sign of the end? He's telling them what to do. Okay, we'll get to that, but don't forget what you're supposed to do before then. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached to all the world as a witness to all nations. Then the end will come. And again, there are those that say, well, Mr. Armstrong did it, or you know, whatever point in time they'll pick. Was the end here yet? No. It's been, what, 36 or so years since Mr. Armstrong died? It's gotten worse, way worse. But we still have a work to do, which means we need to be out there. We need to be putting things on the internet that people in places that we can't travel to can read. And it takes money to do that. Let's look at Matthew 28. He follows up with this. To the disciples specifically, but the principle applies to the church as a whole. Matthew 28, verse 19, he says, go, therefore, and make disciples. Can I make a disciple? Not really. John 6:44, Christ has to call them, so he's making the disciple. What this is talking about here is once he places them in the body, our job then is to help them. So we have to help them become better disciples. Notice, in all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, meaning teach them God's way of life, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. It takes money to travel and meet and counsel individuals God is calling. I put, not that I'm looking for anybody's sympathy, but I'll just tell you, I put about 25, 26,000 miles a year on my cars. And I've seen God take care of them. I do my part, oil changes, tire rotation, making sure everything's up to speed. But the last one I had lasted 12 years. That's a blessing, isn't it? He does these things, but it still takes money to travel. COVID changed that. A lot of those areas have learned to become more self-sufficient, but they still need help. It takes money to cover the expenses of halls for Sabbath days, holy days, these things that I've touched on earlier. God, again, could take care of all of those things, but it is a truism that whatever we spend our money on, we value more. Because we know what it took to get that money, don't we? Okay, so even as a young boy, I still have one of the things on my shelf I bought with my feast money when I was a little boy. Because I remember what it took to earn that money and where I was when I bought it and why I was there. God wants us to value not only the calling that he has given us, but the part we play in helping others have the same opportunity that we have. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 14. Because to this point, what I've talked about is what we would call the first tithe. But there are two others. Second tithe, God tells us to keep so that we can specifically come before him on the holy days. We tend to think of the second tithe as being for the Feast of Tabernacles. And for most of us, that's where the bulk of the money is used. But it is for all of the holy days. Do you need to tank gas? You don't have pocket money? That's second tithe money to go to the holy days. A meal in between, whether it's buying it, preparing it ahead of time, going out to a restaurant in between services. It's being there for other people to give them a ride. It's all of those things, the housing for the Feast of Tabernacles and so forth. So Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22, we read this earlier. You shall truly tithe of the increase, verse 23, and you shall eat it before the Eternal your God in the place that he chooses to make his name live, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil and the firstborn of your herds and your flocks. Notice why, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. Because we again remember who it was to begin with, who owned it, and that it was given to us in the blessings that we have. But even though it was an agricultural society primarily, verse 24, if the journey is too long for you, so you're not able to carry the tithe, because you're going to take all those animals, you're going to take all that grain, you're going to take all that wine, in some cases that's not practical. He says, if the place where the Eternal your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then when the Eternal has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand, go to the place which the Eternal your God chooses, and you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. Now, it's not Christmas. I don't know anybody that does it that way, but it's just not a time for just spending. It's a time, though, to enjoy what we may not be able to enjoy the rest of the year as a foretaste of what God is going to bring. So he says, spend it on what you desire, ox or sheep or wine or similar drink or whatever your heart desires. You shall eat it there before the Eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household, to remember all of these things. But then also notice verse 28, at the end of every third year. So it's not a third tithe every year. It's a third tithe every third year. And technically, that's not accurate, because you do 2 third years, and then the seventh is the year of release, and then you start counting again. So, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. This is not the first tithe. This is not the second tithe. This is the third tithe. And the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, notice, the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied. that the third tithe is used to bless others who don't have the means of their own, that the eternal your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you shall do. We see then from Scripture that tithing is an important aspect of obedience to God and overall instruction, that it was intended for all of mankind, but for now he's working with a few. Tithing and this attitude of obedience to God then changes the outlook, doesn't it? It's not just money. It's not just a bill. It's not just an obligation. That the wealth that we have, the blessings that we receive, are because we obey God and we seek to be like him. And if I can remind, as we read in 2 Corinthians 9:8, that we would sow bountifully. Tithing, then, again, is not just a financial obligation. It is an acknowledgement of our obedience in God's instruction and his promise to provide and take care of us. May we always remember and continue to keep the doctrine of tithing.